Bruce Weber and Jeff Price were fans of Chet Baker's when they set out to make a documentary film about the jazz trumpeter and crooner. The man they found and spent a year with was no longer the James Dean lookalike. He was a lot more weathered, and he'd lost most of his teeth. Their film, Let's Get Lost, debuted to critical acclaim in 1989, but it hasn't been shown since 1993. A new 35mm restoration is opening today at the Film Forum for a three-week run, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Weber and Mr. Price to my show today. Hello. And although we were listening just now to Art Pepper, another great player who had drug problems, who recorded with Chet Baker, and they both, they're part of a long, tragic history of great jazz musicians who had drug problems. When you started making the film, just you must have been very aware that that was a serious concern.
Sure, you know, Jeff and I were both, you know, so enamored of Chet's music, and we always talked about, like, can he still make a film? Can we make a film on him? Will he get through it? And so we really started this film as a small piece from an Oscar Levant song called Blame It On My Youth. Mm-hmm. And so, Jeff, do you remember when we went up to Harlem to the apartment where Chet was staying? That's all we had the intention of doing, really.
And what was his response when you said, I'd like to make a film?
It didn't happen so immediately. We went first to just do a portrait. We went to make a three-minute film portrait of Chet that was actually going to be included in another film about a boxer. Andy Minsker was kind of a Chet Baker double gonger. And but I guess, remember, we shot 3 minutes of film in an environment where Chet was staying that was rather dire, and we
one of many throughout the film.
Yes, this 3 minutes appears in the film actually, and we screened it at Bruce's loft the following day, and I think you said, look at this film. All we should do is film Chet Baker now, and that's all we did for the next year.
Now, Bruce, you were already a well-known photographer at the time, a still photographer.
You know, I sort of feel like I'm always starting out a little bit like Chet in that way, you know, like a jazz musician. Maybe that's why I connected to jazz in my life, you know, because for photography, you know, and filmmaking, you're kind of always starting out again. It's like having a radio show. You're really starting out again each day. So, but I was photographing a lot at that time, and I had known Bill Claxton. Bill had made a film with me, with his wife Peggy Moffat, and photographed me a lot, and I knew these pictures that Bill had done. And
Peggy Moffat was the Rudy Gernreich model, wasn't she?
Yeah, she wore the first totally topless bathing suit. Mm.
And Jeff, you are also a photographer. You're credited as the director of photography. So two photographers on one project?
A photographer and a cinematographer.
Uh-huh. You don't get in each other's ways when you're doing this sort of thing?
Not at all, no. No, that was a wonderful experience to be doing motion picture making with Bruce. It was extraordinary.
And the look is definitely like Bruce's still photographs. That was the intention? That why you shot it in black and white?
Well, you know, I think you bump into people in your life once in a while who somehow have so much of the same appreciation for things. And I hope our eyes are different, but they're the same in a lot of ways, you know. And I think that the way that you interpret a scene, you know, I've always loved Jeff's connection and his openness in his work, and it's a little bit like I do. I always carry usually my cameras around. Today's one of the first days I don't have it, but Jeff always carries his Bolex around, and, you know, and I'm always taking pictures, you know, and I kind of like the fact of You know, Cartier-Bresson said that the first photograph you take of somebody when you're doing a portrait of them is sometimes the best, you know. So that's sort of like the way we worked a little bit.
And jazz musicians often will tell you the first take was the best, even though they do others. Sometimes they make a few mistakes, but they usually like the freshness of the first take. And so the two of you just could lean on each other. But there's also a sense that you wanted this film to be somewhat nostalgic for an earlier time, and the black and white works for that.
Well, what do you feel about that, Jeff? I mean,
well, I always come back to something that Bruce said to me, and it's been a guiding principle, which is it's not so much how you make the photograph, but why you make the photograph. And when we started working with Chet, the reason why was so palpable. You would go into this zone with him, and you would just feel the camera needed to photograph this man. And when you followed the desire to film him, it was black and white, and that was all.
Now, why did the camera need to photograph him? When he was younger, he was extremely handsome. Everybody compared him to James Dean, and in some ways he may have even been better looking than James Dean, if that's possible. But by the time you caught up with him, he was in pretty bad shape, wasn't he? Was there still something charismatic about him?
Oh, yes, totally. The personality, his sensibility of things. I mean, you know, sometimes I think that you sort of end up making a film about somebody or taking a portrait of somebody in a way to save them.
Mm-hmm.
And we all, the whole film crew, we had this vision, this fantasy about him that people would see this film, remember him, fall in love with him and his music, and he would have that really cool car he always wanted to have, the white fence around the house down by the beach, and he would have this beautiful life.
Yeah, didn't time disappear with him a little bit? I found him very handsome, actually, when I met him, and I was nervous at the time. There were almost no Chet Baker albums available at any record store. He was rather obscure. Maybe the jazz catalog was in bad shape at that time.
Well, this is on the transition between vinyl and CD, wasn't it? Now you could pretty much get everything that Chet Baker ever recorded.
Yeah, it was a time where albums were being reissued as twofers, and it was hard to get original packaging. It just wasn't something that was there at the time. I had my collection of Chet Baker records. They were all from the 50s, so I only knew what he looked like as a young man. And when we went to see him that first time, I sat in the car going up the cab, going uptown, so nervous when the door was going to swing open. And it finally did, and there he was. And he was rather handsome, but in dire circumstances. And he came in, and he spoke in the same voice that he sang. And so you calm down. And even though the place looked like an exaggeration of the man with the golden arm, it was wonderful to be around Chet.
But you said, Bruce, that you wanted to save him. And it seems like a lot of people wanted to save him, especially the many women who met him. The one who was his girlfriend when you were shooting the film said that he was something of a con man. So was that part of the appeal?
Well, you know, I think that Chet was a great con artist, but he was also a great romanticist. I mean, the idea that he could meet a girl and fall in love with her when she was playing drums in a pizza parlor, it gave a pizza parlor a whole other allure that normally you wouldn't think about. I think that Chet sort of, he made everybody believe that they were going to be the one to make the change, that he was going to come around and be there for them.
Now, there are mixed reviews of Chet Baker, and some people say it's because he just wasn't as great as the people he admired, like Miles Davis. Others see some kind of a racial component in the whole thing, that he was a white superstar at a time when black superstars were just not getting the kind of support that they should have. Did he ever talk about that with you?
Not really. I mean, do you remember, Jeff, how he didn't really talk very much about other musicians except that night in the bar in Venice, you know? He never really liked to talk about music because for Chet, music came from another place. It came from like a really obscure place, like deep sea diving, you know?
He was a trumpet player. When did he start singing?
He started singing pretty early on, didn't he, Jeff?
The Chet Baker Sings record is very early, yeah.
Maybe
even in the late 40s.
Yeah. And that's part of the mystique because he sang these slow, romantic songs in this very soft, wispy voice. Everybody I know in college had that record, and you automatically put it on when you were on a date.
Right. Yeah. It was a big, you know, I think Chet always knew that, and I think that he used that a lot in his sort of just daily, you know, going to Western Union to pick up money. I think he used it then, you know, as well as, you know, trying to pick up some girl.
How did he wind up playing jazz? He's from Oklahoma, a state that I don't associate with a lot of jazz.
Well, his mom used to tell us stories where they'd turn the radio on and he'd listen to, like, you know, the big band sounds, you know, like Stan Kenton and all those people. And I think, you know, as a little kid, you know, hearing that music and jiving with it a little bit sort of made him, he kind of connected to it in that way.
Right. And he was in the Army and came back and bebop had emerged and he heard Charlie Parker and that was it.
And his dad was a musician, too.
That's right.
But he became associated with the West Coast sound rather than the East Coast sound, and for a while there was a war between the two. He had a long relationship, at least in the early days, with Jerry Mulligan, and they put together a legendary group. He also played with Art Pepper, as we heard earlier, another wonderful West Coast player. But he didn't spend a heck of a lot of time on the West Coast, did he?
No. You know, we were just talking about like how his music came from an obscure place. After Chet passed away, I was having dinner with Jerry Mulligan in New York City, and he asked me some questions about the film. And I said, Jerry, I go, how is it you guys always look so sharp in these beautiful clothes? He said, because we spent every cent we had, you know, on suits. And meanwhile, I knew they were buying a lot of drugs in those days, and I thought, how did they arrange this, the suits versus the drugs, you know? But you know, they were kind of these innocent guys, you know, just having fun, trying to pick up girls, you know.
But you get the feeling also, never growing up, Chet Baker had a lot of kids from different women. I don't have the sense that he was a good father to any of them or even thought about himself as a father to any of them. And then he died in 1988. You were still editing the film at that time?
Yeah, we had just finished... almost are finished the film editing, and we heard the news, and we were in the editing room at the Brill Building, and we all kind of just laid down on the floor. We just didn't think we could go on.
Well, also, I'm sure you were looking forward to having him be present when the film had its premiere. This is just months before the premiere. He fell out of a window in Amsterdam and died?
Well, Anita O'Day told me that she... knew this drug dealer out in Amsterdam, and he said that there's no way he fell out of that window, that it didn't open that much, and that he just probably did like a bad deal and OD'd and they brought him outside.
Mm-hmm. So we have this film which disappeared after 1993 and now it has been restored. Why did it disappear? It got such great reviews.
You know, the film business is kind of funny, and you know, we all pulled our resources to make this film, and there's so many musical cues in this film, and so when we
so
first,
it's expensive.
So it was very expensive, and we first had to do it for only like 7 years. So we spent all this time, you know, really getting all the musical cues for, you know, forever and perpetuity, and you know, Jeff during the film, you know, Jeff would say, "Oh, Bruce, I know this really great Chet Baker song." You know, Jeff was sort of like our Chet Baker you know, encyclopedia. You know, we could always, you know, count on him to tell us exactly a performance, you know.
We met discussing this other film about a boxer, and interested Bruce, he told me, was that he looks just like Chet Baker. Oh, my God, did you know I'm the biggest Chet Baker fan? Oh, really? So am I. So let's just listen to Chet Baker records every day. And we spent every day listening to Chet filming a boxer. And then we went on to, and then that segued right into Let's Get Lost.
Now, we're going to go out with Chet singing Blame It On My Youth, but he sings it Blame It On My Use because he didn't have his teeth. Now, there's a double meaning to all of that because of his drug use, but he couldn't say youth because he'd lost his teeth.
There was a moment where the film was going to be called Blame It On My Youth, and it's such an easy title to kind of assigned to Chet, and I don't know if it's really accurate. I always love the decision at the last moment to change it to Let's Get Lost. I think that's a much better explanation of Chet's life.
But how did he lose his teeth?
He had made a deal with a couple guys, and you know, he just didn't, it got all mixed up, you know. Speaking about Art Pepper at the beginning, you know, Chet had a hard time with Art Pepper. Art didn't like Chet very much, and in the book on Art Pepper, they talk about how, like, you know, Chet would rat on other musicians and et cetera, et cetera.
He'd get arrested, and he would turn in his friends, so
exactly.
They'd get a lighter sentence.
Yeah. So when there's so many stories surrounding how Chet got his teeth knocked out.
But a trumpet player losing his teeth... That's because the teeth are such an important part of a trumpet player's embouchure.
He always had one tooth missing, and he hid it when he was young. All those beautiful photographs of him from the 50s. If he's ever smiling, he's missing a tooth.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And later he's missing all of his teeth, but he had false teeth so he could play the trumpet.
Right.
He had to relearn from scratch.
Well, let's go out with Chet Baker singing Blame It on My Youth or My Use, which is from the soundtrack of Let's Get Lost, which debuted in 1989, not long after Chet Baker died, and now has been restored in a beautiful new 35mm print. The black and white just is so crisp and crackling here. I'm sure that it makes you feel proud of the kind of work that you did. I've been talking to Bruce Weber and Jeff Price, who directed and filmed it. The film is opening today at the Film Forum, and we'll be there for 3 weeks. Here's Chet Baker.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When first we kissed, blame it on my years. If only just for you, I did exist. Blame it on my youth. I believe.
Bruce Weber will introduce the 7 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. screenings of Let's Get Lost tonight at Film Forum. And the 7 p.m. screening will be followed by a Q&A with Bruce Weber, Jeff Price, and editor Angelo Corral. For more information, you can visit our website at WNYC.org. Up next, two doctors take your calls about Alzheimer's on Please Explain. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.